From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we learn the troubled history of the site of the proposed Couture building. Then, Beats Me answers a listener's question about what affects new cancer drug availability, and astronomy contributor Gene Creighton walks us through the science grant writing process. Our family recipe series explores how a dish of cabbage and dumplings can be a testament to the power of memories.
My mom's mother died when she was 12, and obviously I never knew her, but she loved her mother so much, and she told so many nice stories about the things that her mother did, and she loved this dish that her mother made, that then we all loved it.
And Melinda Myers explains how the frigid temperatures are impacting our lawns and gardens.
Gardeners are very tense and frustrated because we all have a long list of things that we wanted to accomplish, and normally we have plenty of time.
Lake Effect is next, but first this news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The site for the proposed Couture building has been plagued by problems for more than half a century. It was once the site of the historic Lakefront Depot, which heralded guests on the Chicago Northwestern Rail Lines for more than 80 years. However, by the time it was bought by Milwaukee County, the building was in need of many repairs and was demolished in 1968. Since then, the site has been besieged by false starts and failed plans. Tom Dakin is a business reporter who covers commercial real estate for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about the site's history.
Thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect once again.
Thank you.
So, you know, the site that the Couture is supposed to be on eventually, I didn't actually know much of the history about that site, but there is a long history here, specifically with Milwaukee County, that in my mind really extends back to 1964.
Right, right, when the county acquired it. It was the Chicago and Northwestern Railway Company's downtown depot and rail yard. Well, specifically the depot, which was this beautiful historic building that sadly was demolished, which preservationists today still lament. That was actually at the site of what's now O'Donnell Park, like right where East Wisconsin Avenue comes to an end. But if you go a little bit south of that, there was also this big rail yard tied to it, and that's basically the Couture site, is the rail yard. And those rail facilities existed for several decades. Chicago Northwestern discontinued service to Milwaukee. The properties were bought by Milwaukee County because Milwaukee County wanted to use them largely as part of a freeway. We were going to have a freeway, incredibly, running along our beautiful lakeshore. It would have been a disaster. It was completely unnecessary. Lincoln Memorial Drive works just fine, but that was the idea at the time. And then enough people opposed that freeway, and combined with the fact that funding for it was shrinking, construction costs were escalating, that eventually that project got canceled by the state legislature. So in the early 80s, the county had these properties, had to start finding a use for them. They came up with O'Donnell Park for the depot site, and then for the rail yard site, they came up with the idea of doing the downtown transit center, which was basically, frankly, a glorified bus barn that was built with mostly federal funding, $10 million, plus, and then that in turn was part of a larger federal grant that also helped create what was called MetroLink. And MetroLink was the idea of having buses connecting workers from the central city to business parks where the jobs are out on the northwest and far northwest side of Milwaukee. The downtown transit center also was built to a great degree because back in the 80s and 90s, you had a lot of downtown buses that were being used by people on their afternoon commute. And to prepare for that, they were kind of lining up and idling on East Wisconsin Avenue and other streets, and a lot of people didn't like that. People living downtown and people working downtown didn't care for it. It was causing traffic congestion, diesel fumes, pollution, et cetera. So we create this glorified bus barn. It was proposed in 1990. It got funded really without hardly any opposition as far as I can tell because, again, federal money, not a lot of local money was involved in it. And it opened in 1992. That was in fall of 92, and within less than a year, there was a story running in the Milwaukee Journal talking about how it's really underutilized, nobody's going there, it's empty as a tomb, et cetera, et cetera. And eventually, the lack of utilization is what led to it being put up for sale and then sold to the couture developer, Barrett Lowe Visionary Development.
So to take a step back, this transit hub was demolished. What happened to the rail yard in the interceding years?
Well, it eventually became a parking lot. I mean, you know, that was the easiest thing to do with it, right? You put some asphalt down and you stripe it with paint and you can start charging people to park there. So that's what it was for much of that period, I think starting in 1970 up until the time that the transit center was built in the early 90s.
So about 20 years, this was
just a parking lot. Yeah. And what was interesting to me in researching this story, I knew the history behind the transit center and why it got built and how it eventually failed. And by the way, it eventually failed in part because also Metrolink failed. Metrolink didn't draw enough riders. You can blame that, I suppose, to some extent on some of the diminishing funding sources for bus service that started really about the time that Metrolink started. So you had service cuts that hurt the ridership. But also the transit center downtown connected those buses to a transit center out at far northwest side, I think Mill Road in 76. And that was probably not the best location because that was probably a little bit further from some of those business parks than you'd hope. But at any rate, it failed. And at the time that it was first proposed, let's go back to 1990, one thing I didn't realize, and I couldn't find any evidence that this was reported in newspaper accounts at the time, the county actually wanted to do more than a transit center there. Now, they had to do some kind of transportation component. That was part of the strings attached to that land that they bought with the federal grant. So because it was originally going to be for a freeway, if you're not going to have a freeway there, you have to do something with transportation. That's how we got the downtown transit center built. But the county, to its credit, did envision something more than just a transit center there. They envisioned it also being a mix of uses. Maybe, you know, maybe you'd have an office building there. Maybe you'd have a hotel. The problem was at that time, let's say 1989, 1990, you just simply didn't have the demand for downtown housing like you have today. No, nowhere near it. Nobody was building downtown apartments at the rate that they're building today. I mean, you had a few projects going on kind of in or near downtown, but nothing like we have today. You didn't really have the demand for hotel rooms like we see today with lots of new hotels that have been going up over the last few years. And as far as office buildings go, in the period from roughly, I think, 83 to 1990, we had four downtown office towers open within that seven-year period roughly, or at least the fourth one was under construction by the end of the decade or start of the 1990s. That pretty much sucked up all the demand for high-end office space downtown. So there really wasn't the appetite to build another one. So basically, the developers weren't interested. They didn't want to do anything at that site at that time. And thus, we got a transit center and nothing else.
So the transit center failed not so long after it was actually built. I was very surprised, though, to see how quickly it was built.
Yeah. Yeah.
It seemed like it was proposed in 1990, and then really by 1992, it's opened.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, it's not the most complex thing in the world. You're right. That seems a little fast, but
for us now, certainly.
Yeah. I mean, a large part of it was just a place for buses to come in and turn around and be marshaled. So you just need a big, wide-open space. Now, they made it nicer than that by having, like, an area for bus passengers to wait, which, of course, nobody used. They had the room that people rented. Someone I know thought about having their wedding reception there and opted not to go there. So they did have that component to it, but I don't think it was the most complex building in the world to build.
As quickly as it was built, its demise seemed to come. About a year later, as you mentioned, 1993, we're looking at them saying, at a city saying, this isn't being used.
Yeah.
Since then, though, since it was sold, things have really stagnated.
As we've reported, I mean, the couture site got sold. Barrett Lowe Visionary Development, led by Rick Barrett, certainly had hoped to be well under construction by now. Granted, there were a few things that he had to deal with, issues he had to deal with, such as the question over where the lake bed was. You can't build private development on former lake bed. It goes against the public trust doctrine. So we had to get a state law passed to change the lake bed boundary. And then there's a legal challenge that was eventually dismissed. You also had to have the Federal Transit Administration, which helped fund the transit center, come in and sign off on everything because, again, they wanted to make sure that whatever was built there, again, had a transit component, hence the transit center that's part of the couture that will eventually, if it ever gets built, service the HOP, the downtown streetcar service. So you did have these things that were obstacles that had to be overcome. But those got overcome, And then, yeah, it hasn't happened yet. And just very quickly, it's a question of financing. Barrett Low Visionary Development still needs to raise, you know, we think around $20 million or so to complete the financing package from equity investors. They presumably will be able to get the loan from HUD. HUD had already kind of signed off on guaranteeing that loan, but got to get the equity investors before you can go back to HUD and apply for the loan guarantee.
It's funny to think about this site in the context of Milwaukee's history, but more specifically, Milwaukee Transit.
Yeah.
Because for more than 100 years, the first site was built in, I believe, 1889.
Yeah.
This has been a place of transit, and yet, for anybody who uses the buses with some frequency, it's really a dead zone. That specific area is kind of hard to get to.
Well, and that probably also explains why it failed. I mean, bear in mind, the depot where everyone came in and out when we had passenger rail service wasn't on Michigan Street where the Couture will be built or maybe built someday. It was up one block further on Wisconsin Avenue, which is really the main east-west street through downtown. Not surprisingly, that's where most of the bus stops are. So a little hard to attract people to a transit center on Michigan Street if a lot of bus stops are up on Wisconsin Avenue. You know, why would you go down to Michigan Street?
It seems like it's so close, and yet when you think of that part of town, it really does feel, especially with the site on Wisconsin Avenue, as you mentioned, it really feels kind of segregated from the downtown area.
Yeah, I think the topography has something to do with that as well. Obviously, everyone who lives here knows that if you go to the end of Wisconsin Avenue, you're essentially on heights. You're on a bit of a bluff. If you go down to Michigan Street, you're really down well below that, and sometimes that can affect our perception of how close or how far things are.
So what happens with the city if they're unable to build this transit center in time?
They have to come up with something else, a plan B, in order to run the HOP, because right now we have tracks on Michigan Street and tracks in Clybourne, but they're not connected, and they would be connected through the transit center. So if we don't get the Couture built, get a transit center built, you got to come up with another way to connect them. Maybe you do it a little bit further to the west. You could conceivably have them take a cross street there, I suppose, and have the link be there as opposed to going through the Couture site. I know at one point there was talk of extending across the Lincoln Memorial, but that I think would be quite expensive.
I think I know the answer to this question, but do we have any kind of timeline?
When Rocky Marcoux, the city development commissioner, was before a common council committee, this goes back several weeks ago, he was pressed on that, and he finally said, well, mid next year, so let's say June of 2020. That might be your timeline.
So right as the DNC is coming to town, we might start seeing some action happening over there?
Yeah, maybe.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, Tom, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and speaking with me.
You bet, Joy. Anytime.
Tom Dakin is a business reporter who covers commercial real estate for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He regularly joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about building and business in the city. You can find more of their conversations at WUWM.com. Coming up after the break, our Beats Me series finds out how clinical trials affect drug availability. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Cancer is the second leading cause of death in the United States, close behind heart disease. So when there's talk of a new cancer drug discovery, patients and their relatives often want to know more about the pharmaceutical and when it might be on the market. For our Beats Me series, WUWM innovation reporter Chuck Kornbach discovers that drug availability often depends on clinical trials.
Grafton resident Jackie Inarelli is a quilter. With no sewing room in her home, she often uses her sewing machine at the kitchen table. Inarelli is doing a lot of quilting these days, but over the last decade, she hasn't always felt up to it because she's had two bouts of breast cancer. The disease is currently in remission. But Inarelli sent us a Beats Me question asking that when we report on possible cancer drugs, that we look into the clinical trial process and how long it takes pharmaceuticals to reach consumers.
I just had a friend who had cancer 15 years ago, and she just died a month ago from this same kind of breast cancer. And every time anyone talks about cancer, it is still the big C. And so you want to find out as much information as you can.
The answer to Inarelli's question often starts at a national network of research centers that get funding from the federal government's National Cancer Institute. The Medical College of Wisconsin is part of that network. More than 250 clinical cancer trials covering at least 13 types of cancer are underway there. Dr. Stuart Wong is a professor of medicine at the college. Wong is also a researcher who runs clinical trials involving volunteer patients. He says those trials only start after much testing in the lab and on animals, and the focus is both on how much harm the drugs may cause and how well they do.
In the laboratory, you look for effectiveness, and in the animal studies, you also look for effectiveness. But when it gets to humans, a great deal of concentration is made on safety and side effects, toxicity. And then you get back to the efficacy. How useful is it in killing cancer cells?
Wong says some of the trials can take years, but he says the Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, which both has to give the go-ahead on clinical trials and gets the final say-so on market approval, has sped up some things.
Maybe a new drug has some very early promising evidence, and then it can be fast-tracked. In response to the fact that there are patients, real patients out there with serious life-threatening diseases, and this is the response.
But while there have been many advances in cancer drugs, controversies remain, including over transparency. NPR reported last month that Canada has decided to post online many company-generated documents summarizing the methods, goals, and results of clinical trials. The U.S. FDA usually treats that information as confidential. Other reports show the pharmaceutical industry, which funds some clinical trials, continues to try to win over researchers and physicians with financial incentives like paid speaking engagements. Dr. Wong says he and many of his colleagues choose objectivity.
I personally, for instance, don't do any of the talks and I don't go to any of the dinners because I'm a researcher and I want to stay as objective as possible.
Wong adds that if he does go to a company-sponsored dinner, he pays his own way. National media also report that to some extent, women and the elderly, and more often racial minorities, are underrepresented in clinical trials. Dr. Jordan Berlin of Vanderbilt University Medical Center agrees the record falls short, including on minorities.
There are a lot of reasons, historical and otherwise, that have led to this. And overcoming this is not necessarily an easy task, but I know a lot of us have been trying very hard to do so.
The Medical College of Wisconsin says it expects its investigators to follow federal policy and require equity by gender, race, and ethnicity for clinical trial enrollments. The college says from July 2017 through June of this year, 55% of research subjects were women. The medical school says it's working to increase minority participation by using culturally sensitive navigators and translation services. Even with refinements in clinical cancer trials, an MIT study last year showed only a small percentage of those drugs win FDA approval. In Grafton, Jackie Inarelli says she's not surprised.
But it still offers you some hope because they're still working on it and they haven't given up on it.
Chuck Kornbach, 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Support for Innovation Reporting is provided by Dr. Lawrence and Mrs. Hannah Goodman.
Chuck Kornbach is WUWM's innovation reporter. He's part of the station's dedicated group of beat reporters who explore listener questions through our Beats Me series. You can find out more about the series and submit a question at WUWM.com. Coming up next, our astronomy contributor describes how science gets paid for. Lake Effect returns in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. It's Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Astronomy contributor Jean Creighton is looking forward to the Thanksgiving break, but not just for the food. She's recently completed her first National Science Foundation grant writing experience as the principal investigator. As she tells Lake Effect's Bonnie North, it's a process that requires a lot of time and coordination.
I hadn't appreciated how much work it is to put together a grant proposal, especially what they call a collaborative proposal, which means that you have multiple people. In this case, it was also multiple departments and multiple campuses. Most grant proposals begin with what we call a solicitation. So the National Science Foundation, NSF for short, says, I want to fund things about, as is this case, advancing informal STEM learning. That's a particular call for proposals. And they give you pages and pages of guidelines of exactly what criteria they want you to address, and specific details also about how you put that proposal together. Because as you can imagine, these proposals can't be 150 pages long. You have to squeeze in your argument about why your proposal is the one that needs to be funded in 18 pages.
So you're essentially having to design a study or a program or whatever it is to meet whatever it is that the funder wants you to find out.
That is right.
Okay.
So that's the one thing, what the funder wants to fund. And obviously, you have to tend to that. But on the other hand, you have some things that you find interesting before you even look at the details of the grant. So you already come with something to the table that you want to look further. And over the years, I've worked with a couple of people multiple times, and you realize that, yes, you're not just interested in one thing, that there may be half a dozen things that are interesting that you could pursue in any order. And then you start thinking, how can I shoehorn what I've got with what the funder wants to fund? And sometimes that's an interesting process in and of itself. And one of the people in the research office said that writing a grant is a discovery process, which I thought was some kind of lovely euphemism. But in fact, I found that to be true, that when you start writing out your ideas about what you would like to do and how you're going to do it, you realize where things are missing, where that's not fully formed, the idea is still morphing. And when other people in your collaboration start taking turns writing stuff, then you also see that your collaborators are looking at the project with different glasses, different lenses, and they see something different. And as a PI, I had to make sure that I was pulling the whole project together so that all collaborators could see at least a portion of the project that they were.
Yeah, it's a lot of stuff to pull together and make sure, and then hope it's funded.
That's a whole nother story. I mean, when you get to a place where you're reasonably happy and you think the argument holds together and everything else, you usually have somebody external to the project to take a look and say, and I can be totally honest now, candid, I should say, the first time the external person looked at it said, nah, not so.
They're not going to fund this. Yeah.
No, the way it is, no. And I confess, I was pretty upset because I thought, oh, and I think it's partially because I'm the kind of person who likes to plan and I get my ducks lined up and I try and prepare for things.
You're a scientist.
Not all scientists are like me, but I try to get things as well positioned as I can. I mean, life throws curveballs at you, but I like to say I did what I could. So this was 5 days before the grant was due, and all these grants have hard deadlines. 5 o'clock, such and such a date, the Wednesday, boom, you either make it or that's it. They don't consider you. So I thought, oh, there's no way we can turn this around. But somebody, a more experienced grant writer, said, oh, we've got lots of time. We can totally address these issues. And we did. And in the end, the final product, I think, was significantly better. And of course, you have all this emotional investment. You've spent all this time. I wouldn't even want to consider how many hours I spent working on this grant. And as a group, how many hours were spent. You have to hope that even if we don't get it funded, I hope we do. But if we don't, the hope then is that we will be in a much better place for the next grant proposal opportunity. The other thing, of course, with grants is there's a certain amount of money, up to a certain amount of money that they'll give you. Then you have to worry about how can you do all the things that you would like within that budget. And that helps focus the mind because you certainly might have walked in thinking, oh, let's do this and this and this and this and this. And then you realize, oh, wait a second.
We have enough money to do this.
That's right. And let's make sure that it's well spent and that we show that we have thought through a reasonable scope of work given the money involved, because NSF can sniff out also projects that are ridiculously ambitious for what, or too generic, or not clear enough that the path of work or the plan of how you would move forward isn't clear, in which case, you know, they would probably just put the proposal aside, even if they liked the idea in the first place.
Is the rigor of the grant writing process similar to the kind of rigor that goes into doing the actual experiments?
I think it's different in the sense that in some ways there's more politics, I think, to it. If you have secured the funding, that means that you convinced a bunch of uncommitted people that your project is good. That probably means, given that all these grants are oversubscribed, that probably means that you have a pretty good idea and you have shown that you know how to move forward. The process of the grant writing is to get you to that place, and people naturally bring different ideas to the table about what that looks like and how we would do it. So I think the grant writing is more about converging to a common plan, whereas when you're doing the work, it's more clear who's doing what.
Okay.
Not that that doesn't change, right? I mean, life will throw you a curveball and then you realize, oh, we all thought that was a great idea, but for various reasons, you can't do it. So you have to pivot and do something different. But then you already are rewarded for the idea that you had. So you're motivated to keep going. You know the money's there. You know that you have to report to the NSF, what did you do with your money? Whereas a grant proposal that hasn't yet been funded is still something that can feel like, oh, this is so much work. Oh, I might not get it. Oh, I could drop it. You know, it's a different mentality.
Right. Once you've got the money, you're committed to doing the work.
You really have to, yeah. Yes, because NSF really doesn't like it.
Yeah. No. I think no granting authority likes it when you waste their money.
Right. Well,
and you'll never get another grant.
That's right. You know, that's right. And there's also the issue of if you get it awarded, then you're spurred to spend the money. So then you have to do the activities. You have to, you know, have the people that you said and all the things that travel, whatever it is that you needed to do. So it's been a growing, interesting process, and I thought it might be fun for our listeners to hear how many scientists today, probably thousands in the world, are beating their heads to think how to make the coolest project possible that can be funded with public money to learn new things about how we learn and about the cosmos.
Astronomy contributor Jean Creighton is the director of UWM's Manfred Olson Planetarium. She spoke with Bonnie North. Coming up next, we get some comfort food from Slovakia in our next Family Recipes installment. Lake Effect returns in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Most of us are deep in preparation for Thanksgiving. Whether we're cooking ourselves or enjoying someone else's labor, the meal tends to remind us of family. Thanksgiving recipes aren't the only ones that bring back memories of family, of course. And for this month's Family Recipes segment, contributor Lucian Jung visits Milwaukee resident Michael Dillon to learn about a Slovakian dish that has a special meaning for him. Michael fondly recalls his mother preparing it when he was a child. It's a traditional old-world pairing of cabbage and dumplings that evokes memories of a beloved family figure.
So this is the thing that her mother made and her grandmother made, Zelova Slezia. And so when I was there in Czech Republic last week or 2 weeks ago, I asked people, have you heard of this? And it is a name that I think is just made up. Although Zela is a Czech word for cabbage. And there is a slanau or something like that, that means fried in bacon. Well, we didn't do that. We used butter. So
why is that?
I don't really know, because my great-grandfather was a butcher, and it would seem like they would have used bacon, but they didn't. And I don't know. You know, my mom was born in 1929 in the beginning of the Depression, and they didn't have anything.
Well, it seems that Depression-era cooking, they modified the recipes for the times.
Mm-hmm. And so that's this. I mean, this was Depression food that I always liked, I think in some part because my mom's mother died when she was 12. And obviously I never knew her, but she loved her mother so much. And she told so many nice stories about the things that her mother did. And she loved this dish that her mother made that then we all loved it.
Your mom was kind of a stay-at-home housewife. She always had home-cooked meal prepared.
Oh, absolutely. My mom was a very, very good cook. I mean, a competent cook for... you know, five kids, and my dad was a teacher. They had no money. And so, you know, it'd be like we had spaghetti on Monday and stew on Tuesdays and chop suey, which was a can of Chinese vegetables in the stew, that kind of thing, and fish on Fridays.
Well, tell me about this recipe. When would she make this?
You know, I don't know, just periodically. I can't think of specific times that she made it. But I do recall when I was a teenager, my uncle, who at the time was a priest, and so we were his only kids, he came to our house. He called his Aunt Anne, who was his mother's younger sister, and she told him the recipe. And that's really how I remember the recipe, from my mother's aunt telling us how to make the dumplings and fry the cabbage.
You pronounce the name of this dish as?
Zelova Slezia.
Okay.
But there is no such thing as that. I've Googled it a million different spellings. And my guide in Prague was a woman who was from a town near where my grandmother, great-grandmother was born. And the town is called Lešarska Nová Ves. And anyway, the woman was from near there. And she said that town is on the Czech and the Slovak border. And they speak a mix of both Czech and Slovak. And so she just thinks that it's something that either we have bastardized throughout the years or that that was just a family name.
When you were in the Czech Republic, did you taste anything that was similar to this?
No. And I tried. I tried, but there was not. They had, they had cabbage rolls, which is also something my mom made, and sauerkraut and things like that. And so.
Well, it's certainly the star ingredient here seems to be cabbage.
Well, yes, but the dumplings make it something really special, so.
Okay, so this is going to be pretty much sautéed cabbage with homemade dumplings.
Right.
And you have, you're explaining earlier that your mother used to grate the cabbage.
Yes, she had a box grater, and it looked like hell to me.
Yeah, these big
and she aluminum things. On this side of it.
Oh, she used the small?
Yeah, and it would come out like that, and she would just... and get her knuckles bloody. And
oh my gosh. And you just weren't going to do that.
No, I was not going to do that.
So you pulled out the Cuisinart.
Well, I did. I actually was going to do it if I did a test sample in the of the cabbage in the Cuisinart, and it was like, it's perfect. Then if it hadn't been, I would have grated it on there. I would have done that all morning.
So now after you grate the cabbage, then what do you have to do to it?
Fry it in butter.
Okay. Did you salt it or anything like
that? No.
Oh, really?
Nope. I asked her yesterday, should I salt it and let it drain? And she said no.
Okay, so simply just making sure that the cabbage isn't a very small, fine, almost a mince.
First, I feel like I need to make the dumplings.
Okay, what goes into the dumplings?
This is just eggs, water. I put some nutmeg in here, which isn't necessarily something they have, but...
Oh, so now you're adding your own.
It just seems like nutmeg should go in there, so I did add my own take on it, yeah.
I see you're adding flour to a concoction that you have made here.
Yeah, this is eggs and water and salt.
Okay, eggs, water, and salt, and you've just added some flour to that.
Yeah, to make it the right consistency, which I'm not really sure what the right consistency is, but I should say my mother, when she would make it, usually put in egg noodles. She didn't go to the bother of this. She had five kids. She was too busy. There was laundry to be done and whatnot. But she did do that sometimes, but mostly she used egg noodles. Klusky Zupa.
So she would saute the cabbage, but then just use packaged noodles.
Yeah.
And it was just for those special occasions when she
made
the homemade noodles.
I wouldn't call them special, though. I mean, this was something that she would, like, get a taste for, you know, like maybe wanting to remember her mother or something like that.
When she was feeling nostalgic.
Yeah.
Then the box grater comes out.
Right.
Okay. So now the texture here with the dumpling mixture is loose, slightly sticky, but it's not like a bread dough.
No, it's a batter, really. And because it has a high egg content, it'll cook very quickly.
Okay. So you've got a really big pot of boiling water.
Right.
Did you salt it?
Yes.
Okay, so salted boiling water. So you're now putting the batter into a colander. And what are you going to do?
I'm
going to
push the batter through the holes, and they should drop into the boiling water.
So this is so interesting, because you're just using a colander, and you're just pushing the batter through it. This is what your mom did?
Yes. Yeah, just like this.
So I see that the batter, as it's going through the holes in the colander, it's forming these little dumplings.
Right. It's like a German Spätzle, or however you say that.
How do you know when the dumplings are done?
It's pretty done right now.
It's only been on the stove for about 15 seconds.
Yes, but they're just tiny little things, and they're going to get a second cooking I'm going to fry them with the cabbage and butter.
Oh, so we're cooking these dumplings twice?
Yes.
Okay, so these dumplings have been cooking for, 15 to 20 seconds, and now you're taking them out of the boiling water.
Mm-hmm.
And we're getting ready to sauté them in the pan.
Yeah, now we're going to sauté the cabbage.
So the pan is hot enough for the cabbage to just start sizzling once it hits the pan.
Right.
And then because it's minced, it's going to cook very quickly, I imagine.
Right.
So this is not like sauerkraut.
No, it's not. Strangely, sauerkraut, when you cook with sauerkraut, it doesn't cook very quickly. Cabbage does. I don't know what it is about the pickling process of cabbage that makes it doesn't fall apart easily. My Uncle Jerry loves like pork chops and sauerkraut, but you got to cook the sauerkraut for like an hour before you start the pork chops. And I learned that from Julia Child.
So this was never intended to be a fermented cabbage dish then?
No. It's funny too, because in my Irish family, cabbage and potatoes mixed together, it's called colcannon, that's a really popular Irish thing.
So there's some similarities in the cuisine of...
Well, I think it's the similarities in poor people.
Yeah, you rely on the basic ingredients.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Flour, potatoes, cabbage, root vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
So the burner's definitely at a high heat.
Turn it down a little bit. This also looked a little dry, so I added another tablespoon of butter.
Okay, so you kind of have to watch the cabbage as you're sauteing. You want it to get browned, and you want it to be moist.
And it's going to go really fast. I mean, you can see it's browning already.
And you never they never do stock or anything?
I asked my mom yesterday, and she said, no, you want it to brown, and if you put stock in there, it's not going to... My youngest sister, Anne, told me to I should put chicken stock in it, but I don't see that.
Isn't it funny how we're always trying to complicate simple dishes?
Well, I am. I like all that kind of putzing around complication. Mm-hmm.
So maybe the trick is we just have to restrain ourselves and stick with the basic recipe.
Well, you know, it depends upon what you want to end up with. And I think every family had their own, that the woman who was my guide in Prague said, you know, everyone's family had their own version of this, although I don't know how many versions of this you could really have.
Your version, it utilizes flour for the dumplings and butter to saute the cabbage in.
And there's where I would put chicken stock if I was gonna, but it just looks a little too dry.
Okay, so if it's looking a little too dry, then just add some liquid. You could do water or chicken stock, but just be careful to add it after the cabbage has started to really brown.
Yes. And then taste.
Of course. How is it? How's the seasoning?
Salty enough. It's delicious.
You know, I think some people that are put off by the strong flavor of sauerkraut, they should realize that fresh sautéed cabbage, it's a completely different thing.
Yes, absolutely different thing. And you don't smell anything here, cabbage.
No. And it's almost like just a sautéed fresh green.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. I think that people actually do put kale in here as well, but I'm not a big kale fan.
Well, I've heard actually the kale was one of those staples back in the day that we're just rediscovering. So maybe in the original recipes, they did utilize something like kale.
It could be.
We think it's so fancy now.
Kale is a member of the cabbage family. So, and in fact, the word for cabbage in German is kohl, coleslaw. So.
Okay, now we're going to add the dumplings.
And that's it. Zelvislesia.
So, you can taste the butter, you can taste the salt, you've got the creaminess of the dumplings and that kind of vegetal, is that a word? Sort of that vegetal feeling from the cabbage. It feels really earthy.
I mean, it has a kind of, the cabbage has a kind of sharpness to it too. There's a little bit of a heat that comes from it.
And the salt and pepper, maybe the pepper.
Maybe, but no, cabbage does have a little bit of, you know, like radishes are part of that same family, so.
That's what I'm tasting. It's a radish kind of flavor.
Yep, yeah.
And these dumplings, they're not mushy.
No, they're chewy. I mean, the eggs, because there's high egg content. It's one cup of flour and two eggs in it. And so that makes them really chewy.
So if we didn't add the eggs, then they would be kind of mushy and they fall apart?
They would be more, they would definitely be softer, but they wouldn't have that texture. And the nutmeg adds the flavor, but the eggs are what give it the bite, the texture.
And there's a kind of emotional feeling when you eat it. It sounds really strange, but it's comforting.
Yeah, it is definitely a comfort food.
What do you think that is? That it's why?
Well, for me, you know, it's my childhood, it's my mother, and then it also reminds me of her talking about her mother, and that was really fun for us kids.
Well, I just want to talk a little bit about Prague. You were in Prague earlier this year, and you said that you decided to research the origins of this recipe.
I mean, I wasn't like, you know, tracking people down with a bloodhound and going to libraries and stuff. I just asked people.
But why was it important for you to get more information about this recipe?
It's tied up in our grandmother and how much we didn't know her, but we still loved her. It's also interesting to me because we all grew up feeling Irish, but really we have cousins who've come here from, they live in Bratislava in Slovakia. I mean, we have closer ties to Bohemia or Slovakia than anything else.
Those Slovakian roots are what are closest to your heart.
Yeah, we had, and like my Irish grandmother, she was really the difficult person. And all we had with my Bohemian grandmother was just the warm, comforting stories that we knew about her. We never had, like my Irish grandmother, one time I was reaching onto the table and she took the flat end of the knife and went on my hand, like, yeah. And then the German side of my family, my grandfather, they were very Catholic and they weren't a big celebration group of people, but I hadn't really thought about it until you just said that, but we do have this thing for our grandmother we didn't know.
Well, gosh, it sounds like you really got to know her through your mother's memories of her and the warmth that she felt in that relationship.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And every time your mother, it sounds like that your mother missed her, she made this dish.
Well, you know, that's a good point. It probably was when she needed comfort. Yeah, I mean, she had five kids and it was hard, you know, and my grandmother got breast cancer and was sick when my mother was 9. And then my mother started running the household. So I'm sure that when she was very young, she was making this.
Contributor Lucian Jung produces our family recipe series. You can find today's recipe at WUWM.com. We'll take one last break, then gardening expert Melinda Myers joins us to talk about winterizing your garden, even after winter has already arrived. Like Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. More of Like Effect now. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The cold weather that settled in earlier this month wasn't just unexpected for people, it also surprised our gardens. While people were still dealing with falling leaves and fall cleanup, the snow came barreling down, creating a mixture of ice, snow, and garden debris. And while it might not be the most fun time to be in the garden, there is still much to be done. Gardening expert Melinda Myers joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about winterizing and navigating a partially frozen landscape.
So it seems like overnight it became winter.
Yes.
What kind of impact is that having on people's gardens and yards?
Well, I think, first of all, gardeners are very tense and frustrated because we all have a long list of things that we wanted to accomplish. And normally we'd have plenty of time, the end of October and early November. So we'll start with the easier, the hard one, our lawns, all those leaves that fell down that we didn't get raked up or haven't fallen yet and will fall down either on the snow or after the snow melts and snow comes again. Anything we can do to get them off our lawn is a good thing because those big leaves, they'll be wet, they'll mat down, they'll block the sunlight, trap moisture, increases the risk of disease. If you don't get to them, make a note so in spring, as soon as you can get out there anytime, that the ground, you know, the grass blades aren't frozen because you don't want to walk on frozen grass because you'll end up breaking those blades. But lightly rake a leaf rake, get them off. So if you don't do it this fall, make it a priority for the spring. For trees and shrubs, a lot of things had their leaves, still do. And only good thing I can say is we've had some consistently cold temperatures leading to the snow and the extremely cold. So I think plants were starting to harden off. A lot of plants lost their leaves green. It's going to be a wait and see. I haven't seen a lot of breakage yet, so hopefully other people haven't had branches breaking under the weight of the snow. Anytime we get a reprieve, if you haven't tied up your upright arborvitae or junipers that tend to split, right? You see them all over in the spring where the snow piles up, the top splits open. Bird netting, some cotton strips loosely tied just so those stems are held together so those snow rolls off. You know, again, wait for it to be warm. If the plants are frozen and you move them around, you're going to have some cracking and damage. So sometimes we do more harm than good when we try to intercede. Some of the damage we're going to have to just wait and see. You know, see what the winter brings, see what the spring brings. Containers. Hopefully your planters, especially that are in clay pots or glazed pots or in a safe place or, you know, in between these cold snaps, get them into a shed. If you've got pots that have perennials, trees and shrubs that aren't reliably hardy in a pot outside. So typically we say one zone hardy or at least a big pot if you're going to leave them out all winter. If you need to overwinter them, an unheated garage, burying the pot in the ground, so it depends on if the soil's frozen and if you have a vacant space to bury it, grouping them together in a sheltered place. And then what I like to do is I'll bag my leaves, put them around. I'll take my annual pots, like the petunias and impatiens, they're dead anyway, right? Set those pots around the pots of perennials, trees, and shrubs for insulation. That's basically what we're doing, and throwing snow on top.
Well, and one of the questions I had was, you know, you mentioned the soil. Is the soil already frozen because it's frozen on top of it?
Good question. So one of the things, the snow did come. I was doing some planting right before one of the more recent snowstorms. It's hard to keep track. And I was able to dig down and get in there. It was a little crispy, but it was easy to dig. So the snow is a good insulator. So it is protecting our plants. When it recedes between these early snowfalls, I've been able to get in a little frosty, but not hard to break through. Usually it's just the top layer. Last year, if you remember, we had 9 degrees early, and I was planting bulbs, and it was really cold, and I was breaking through about an inch of crusty soil. And so I was able to dig through. The soil underneath was thawed. I was able to put my bulbs in, and then I just put that crunchy layer on top so that the squirrels would have a harder time digging in after my bulbs. So if you can get in through that first layer, and we're still pretty good, it takes, you know, the weather's been so changeable, it's just going to be a wait and see. Some parts of your yard may be frozen where the snow lingers. Some may have thawed out earlier, like the south side where the sun's warmed it. So it may be just take out your trowel and dig if you need to get some things in the ground.
Well, and one of those things, as you just mentioned, is bulbs.
Right.
A lot of people did not get their bulbs in before that snow and ice came down. You mentioned before being careful of walking on your grass when it's really frozen like this. Dealing with plants too much can be a little detrimental.
Right.
If you still need to get some stuff in the ground, how should you navigate that?
You know, great question. So I plan on still getting my bulbs in the ground. Hopefully everybody else is lucky too. But try not to wear a path, first of all. You know, if we get temperatures over freezing and the grass is exposed, then those blades don't have ice crystals inside, so you do less damage. If it's covered with snow, that snow insulates, so that is also helps cushion your footprints. You know, try to avoid putting equipment on there. You know, carry your basket of bulbs out, brush the snow away if you need to, and then do your digging. And so the less you walk on frozen grass, the better. Sometimes I know we had a couple places in our yard last year that I wore a few tire marks through trying to get things in, and I had to look at them all spring. They came back. It just was a reminder that I should do what I say, not what I was more convenient to do.
So of the many things that we do to generally winterize our gardens, what can we still do with the weather like it is? And what should we just
give up?
Give up. Yeah.
Well, one thing a lot of people do is cut back their gardens. And really, it's better to leave them stand. So I think this year is going to force a lot of people that like neat and tidy yards in the winter to leave things stand. A lot of our pollinators overwinter there. The motion of the grasses and the seed heads feed the birds. And so that's very positive. If you have disease problems in your garden, cutting back to the ground and then getting them out of your yard is a good idea. If your pumpkins end up frozen to the garden, you may have some pumpkin plants growing there, you know, the seeds falling. So you can either move them to a more appropriate spot or enjoy that free plant that you received. Pruning, I like to wait until the end of winter to do pruning for a couple of reasons. If we do have damage, you're taking care of it at the same time, especially evergreens. If you think about boxwoods had a lot of damage last year, but if you think about evergreens, those outer needles or leaves have been exposed to the weather all summer. If we prune those off in the fall, those that have been shaded and sheltered are now exposed to winter conditions. We've had plenty of rain, so one of the things we always like to do is water thoroughly in the fall before the ground freezes. So nature has helped us with that. Mulching, if you didn't get it done this fall, spring is also another time, or summer. Or if you've got that pile of mulch on your driveway, you can throw it on top of the snow. But in terms of mulching perennials and bulbs, wait till the ground is frozen to put straw or evergreen branches on top.
All right. So for those of us who are adventurous enough to go out and do some stuff in our garden, there's still some stuff to do, but let's maybe lay off on all of it.
Exactly. This is a good chance for procrastinators to procrastinate a little longer.
Well, Melinda, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you, Joy.
Melinda Myers is the author of several books on gardening, and she's also a regular Lake Effect contributor. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers, and you can find some of their previous conversations at WUWN.com. And that's today's edition of Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.